Good morning.
Echo.
Yeah, there is an echo. Would like to welcome everyone to a little bit of feedback here. I'd like to welcome everyone to a special city council meeting for the Mesa City Council Thursday, November 6, 2008. And the purpose for this meeting is to take action on a special event liquor license application. And the reason we need to do this is because it's a 5 one-day charitable events. The first one is this Saturday. So we need to take care of that. So I'll entertain a motion.
So moved.
I have a motion from Councilmember Summers, second from Councilmember Fenter. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion is unanimous with Councilmember Kavanaugh not present. Any items from citizens present, Ms. Crocker?
No requests, Mayor.
Okay, I entertain a motion to adjourn.
Second.
Moved by Councilmember Richin, second by Councilmember Summers. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? We are adjourned for the special council meeting.
More meetings.
Yeah, that was good. Now moving to the study session agenda. First item on the agenda is to hear a presentation and discuss state and city water issues.
Mayor?
Oh.
Can I just start?
Sure, Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. Mayor and City Council, as you recall, a few months ago, we discussed some of the transportation issues, regional transportation issues. We brought in representatives from the region to talk about what's taking place and perspective of what's going on across the state and our region related to transportation. Today, we wanted to shift our focus to water and talk about just kind of introducing the council to the fundamentals, I guess, if you want to say, about water resources as they relate both to Mesa and the region in which we're affected. Obviously, living in a desert, the issue of water resources is very important to the city of Mesa. So today, I'm going to go ahead and let Catherine introduce our guests and our topic. Catherine.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning, Mayor, Council. I am really happy to introduce Rita Pearson McGuire. When I first met her, she was the director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources, and I knew her as such for many years as one of our staunchest defender of our Colorado River rights against those usurpers, California and Nevada. And I think that we're really fortunate to have her here today. So with no further ado, Ms. McGuire.
Thank you, Catherine. Good morning. I'm delighted to be here, Mayor, and members of the council. This is my favorite topic, obviously, and so I appreciate the opportunity to engage with the council, and I really do mean that. If you have questions, please interrupt. I love the kind of Q&A dialogue, and I'm happy to answer any questions, and if I don't know the answer, I'll ask Catherine.
You're in trouble.
So this morning we're going to talk about municipal water demands, but I think I'm going to try to give the 30,000-foot perspective, so give you just a good overview of how the big picture looks with respect to Arizona's water supply, with a particular emphasis on municipal water demands, because obviously that's the most critical demand in your eyes, I think, and it is also the most inflexible demand, so it's the one that we've really got to make contingency-type plans for in the events of droughts or dramatic changes in our water supply. Let me just start with the basic question, the one that everyone wants to know the answer to, and that very simply is, do we have enough water? And the answer is, of course, an unequivocated yes and no. Yes, we do have plenty of water. We're remarkably blessed with a water supply, primarily in our groundwater aquifers. That is what has made Nevada so covetous of our water supply, is that certainly in southern Nevada, they have very shallow aquifers, many of them perched. They really cannot rely on groundwater storage as we do here in Arizona. We, on the other hand, have massive aquifers. Here in southern Arizona, they're alluvial aquifers, in a sense, and the hydrologists always cringe, but sort of the bathtub concept of big, huge supplies of water underground that are relatively accessible and fairly easy to reach and consistent in their deliveries. That's not true in all parts of the basins, but it certainly is generally true. If you go to northern Arizona, you have what are known as bedrock aquifers. They are fractured granite-type aquifers that are difficult to reach, and depth to water supply runs in the neighborhood of 2,000 to 3,000 feet below land surface. Costs about $1 million per 1,000 feet to simply drill a well, and when you get there, you got no guarantee that you're going to meet a sustainable water supply. So it's a much more of a hit or miss type of situation. And yet the aquifer itself, and I'm talking about the Coconino Plateau in particular, has abundant water supplies. The trick is finding it and being able to access it. I'd like to go to this map because it really demonstrates the significant growth pattern that we're projecting for Arizona. No surprise, certainly, to the members of this council. But you can see that in a 50-year period, a very dramatic increase in the size of the population, predominantly along the transportation corridors, north on I-10, up through I-17, and then east-west along the I-40 corridor. We're going to see dramatic growth in population. And frankly, our population is not always located where the water supply is. Generally in the west, that has been true. Certainly in the easily accessible aquifers, you found communities locating themselves. But as we've gotten more sophisticated with our water supplies, we're locating further and further away from easily accessible water supplies, and now we've got to figure out how to get the water to the people. There are really four basic sources of water in Arizona, and they're all managed differently. There's a different system of law, so it keeps all the water lawyers, you know, fully employed. When we talk about the Colorado River, we're talking about a combination of federal and state law, driven principally by that famous court case, Arizona versus California, or David versus Goliath, as I like to say. And in this case, Arizona was David and very successful, and were able to obtain a very substantial allocation of Colorado River water. It is now a significant part of our water portfolio. Without it, Central Arizona would be in serious trouble today. The other surface water supply is a combination of resources, predominantly from the Salt and the Verde and the Gila River. So that watershed that delivers water, of course, through this Salt River Project system. Very significant. It delivers about 1 million acre feet into the Phoenix metropolitan area every year. That is governed by state law, not federal law, an entirely different system of laws than what you see for the Colorado River system. Then you get to groundwater, yet another system of laws governed by the 1980 Groundwater Management Act. Many identify the Groundwater Management Act as the most significant piece of water legislation, certainly in the West and maybe in the country. And I know when I was director, we regularly had delegations from Saudi Arabia, from Texas, from Hawaii even, everyone asking us, how did we manage to adopt this legislation? And frankly, the key was the old bait and switch. In simplest terms, we were able to shut down access to groundwater over the long haul, making it increasingly difficult to use groundwater for municipal delivery in particular. But the only reason we were able to do that is because we were offering a substitute supply, the Colorado River supply brought in by the Central Arizona Project. But for that notion, I think it would have been even more difficult than it was. And in fact, there was a water commission that met for 3 years just to develop this legislation. And the story goes that at the end of the day, the reason why the Central Arizona Project is here is in part there's a direct relationship between it and the Groundwater Management Act. We were told by then President Carter and his Interior Secretary Cecil Andrus that if the state of Arizona did not adopt a groundwater management code, the funding for the Central Arizona Project may not come through. And of course, we were heavily dependent on federal dollars to build this canal system. And so that in part was the impetus for finally, the various stakeholders, which was a combination of industrial users like the mines, agricultural users, of course, the major irrigation districts, and the cities. And they ultimately came to agreement with the Groundwater Management Act, which has really been sort of the lifeline for Central Arizona in ensuring that we've got a portfolio of water supplies and using that water supply hopefully in the most efficient manner possible. The last supply is the only supply that's growing, and that's effluent. Effluent grows with the people. It used to be that cities were looking to get rid of their effluent, looking for any deal that they could strike, particularly with irrigated agriculture, to deliver effluent in lieu of groundwater rights that agriculture may have or surface water rights. Today, though, it commands a fairly high price. It is a very valuable resource, and you even see communities, certainly in the Pinal County area, where you've got new subdivisions going in, where you're doing the dual piping, the purple pipe to deliver non-potable water supplies for landscape use and reserving that potable water supply for in-home use. So becoming increasingly efficient about how we use that water supply and also managing it hopefully a little with a little less expense by minimizing some of the total treatment costs associated with our water supplies. Here's a fairly simple way to think about what the state's water budget looks like, looking at the different sources of water I just discussed. Today, we're using about 40% of our water budget being made up of groundwater, and that continues to decrease, and it varies, of course, by location. Pima County, we probably only have about a third of the water supply coming from groundwater. Less agriculture there and a greater emphasis on the utilization of CAP water and, of course, less alternate surface water, unlike Phoenix, who has the Salt River system, the Verde River system, delivering water. Tucson really is wholly dependent upon groundwater and CAP supplies. 50% being supplied by
Councilmember Higgins.
No, I just had a question on that about the 40% groundwater. How much of that groundwater is? This is a hard question, but you know that we recharge the groundwater after the wastewater treatment plant. Do you know like a percentage? You know, I know it's hard because it's not the water we're actually pulling out of the ground; it's recharging the aquifer. But you know what percent that is, or?
Boy, that's a good question. I should know that, and I don't off the top of my head. It's growing, I can tell you that, rapidly, and there's a huge program just emphasizing recharge. But I don't know, Catherine.
I don't either.
I'd be happy to get back to you on that, yeah. Certainly, Central Arizona is the key location for recharge. Recharge doesn't work nearly as well in places like those fractured bedrock aquifers I was talking about earlier. So you've got to have the right setting for it. Central Arizona is the key place for that type of activity. That last bullet, use of reclaimed water is increasing. That number goes up literally annually. It has gone from 3% now. I've got 7, and I've seen it as high as 9 and 11. So that number is growing, and that's an important part now of our water portfolio. And I should point out, of course, the fundamental difference between groundwater and surface water is one is a non-renewable supply, in essence. Groundwater takes millennia to recharge. I mean, we can do it artificially, and we can increase the water supply, but we really do try to look at that as the backstop. I look at it as almost an IRA type of thing. That's our savings account. We draw on that as a choice of last resort so that we know that it's there when we need it, but we also understand that it's a finite supply and we have to be very careful about accessing it and drawing on it. Whereas that surface water is responsive to Mother Nature, it renews itself every year. To the extent we can make use of it, it's a preferable water supply, certainly in a desert environment. And of course, ultimately, increasing the utilization of effluent will preserve both the surface water and the groundwater supplies in the future. Oh, and I should point out, statewide demand, 7.87 million acre feet. When I was starting out as director of DWR back in 1993, that number was 6.3 million acre feet. So you can see a substantial increase over just a decade in our water use. Here's another way to look at the water budget. This is a little bit out of date, but I really wanted to rely on DWR's numbers, and the numbers that they're showing is we're still the predominant use of our water supply is agriculture. That, of course, varies substantially by region as well. Again, Pima County, relatively small percentage of agriculture, much greater municipal demand and industrial demand. here in the Phoenix area, we're still probably not at 80%, and certainly Salt River Project is a perfect example of where you've seen the flip from being predominantly an agricultural water supplier to now, by a long shot, a predominantly municipal water provider. And that's consistent with the other irrigation districts you see around the valley, is now this urbanization of farmland, which is very consistent with the principal goal of the Groundwater Management Act, to develop on farmland as opposed to raw desert, so you were switching that water use.
Councilmember Richens.
What uses more water, land or house, or farms or houses?
Well, go right back to that first slide. It depends. It depends on the density of the municipal use on that acre. So an acre of farmland may use 2 or 3 acre feet of water per year, and a municipal demand may be comparable or less, but the higher the density, then the higher the municipal water use. So we used to always say, oh, you know, municipal water use is less demanding on an acre of land than farming, but that really depends on how you zone the property.
Do you know what the density tipping point is for that?
I don't, Catherine.
I do know that SRP, for example, will tell you that they have not seen their total demands go down as the lands have urbanized, that they feel it's been basically an even swap out here in the valley.
Growing under our current pattern.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, yeah, as they've converted from agriculture to municipal, their total demands have not diminished.
So if we start growing differently, like what, for example, what DMB is proposing, how will that affect?
Certainly it will. On project here in the city of Mesa, our water use is about 2.2 acre feet per acre. So, yeah, you would expect as densities increase for that to reach as high as 3 acre feet per acre.
Which is the
tradition. You have to also look at that because, you know, it's not a straight trade-off either, because we're taking farmland out of production, but we're also building in non-irrigable, how do you want
to
say that?
Desert lands, yeah.
Desert land. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not – I can see where SRP, since most of the areas within their project have been irrigated, but there's an awful lot also that was desert land that was not mm-hmm. farmed at all, or it was fallow farmland also, so it's hard to tell.
And a good example here in the valley is North Scottsdale, Cave Creek, Carefree were never farmed, and so for a while there we were not seeing that sort of equilibrium being achieved because so much of the growth was coming on raw desert and we were not retiring farmland. But as the East Valley has expanded and the West Valley, we're now seeing a better trade-off with respect to the retirement of irrigated agriculture in exchange for that municipal development. The question on everybody's mind, what if an extended drought is normal? Certainly the sort of the big revelation in the Colorado River discussions in the 1990s was, whoops, the climatologist, the dendrohydrologist. I'm proud of myself at 7:45 that I got that out. So the tree ring studies basically were showing that, in fact, 30-year cycles of drought, extended drought periods, were not atypical, but in fact were normal, that in fact we could expect that we would experience times in which we would have very dry seasons 20 to 30 years at a time. And that became a very frightening concept to us. One, and you probably have already heard this, the Colorado River supply, as we understand what is a normal flow for the Colorado, is overallocated. Back in the 1920s, when the states and the federal government sat down to divvy up that water supply, they thought that a normal flow, an average year for water in the Colorado, ran about 16.5 million acre feet a year, maybe 17. And so they thought, well, if we allocate 15 million acre feet, we've got some fudge room and we're going to have wet years and we're going to build reservoirs, so we're in good shape. In fact, we think that a normal flow is closer to maybe 14 million acre feet. So we're concerned that we've already committed ourselves to take more water than we can typically expect to receive in the Colorado River system. The 20th century, as we know it, was generally a wet period. We've had extended droughts in the 1500s. We saw more concentrated extended droughts in the 1950s right here in Arizona, very dramatic declines in water supplies. But then again in the 80s and 90s, we saw some fairly wet years. That 500-year flood came several times. So we've seen variations. We think that these extended drought periods are likely to occur as they've been predicted to occur. If you've got more water than you've got people, not a problem. That's not true anymore. Certainly here in the lower basin, the three Colorado River sharing states, Nevada, California, and Arizona, now use every drop that they're entitled to annually and then some. They would take more if they could. And so if we get hit with an extended drought, as we were seeing in the early part of this century, the storage in Lake Powell, the storage in Lake Mead, dropped by almost 50% in 5-6 year period. So we were going from being 95% full to about 50% full. Scared the pants off of most water managers because we didn't really think that it could drop that quickly. And of course, the important point for us here in Arizona is we're the low priority user with respect to the deliveries that come through the Central Arizona Project. So when shortages are declared on the system, we are the first entity to feel the pinch of shorter supplies. So, you know, and when I was director, you know, we would do the chest beating thing of, you know, we're one of the fastest growing states in the country, if not the fastest, you know, the Maricopa County, you know, do the whole litany of why water supply is so critical to us here. But an old-time water lawyer, and it's possible there's some older than me at this point, who reminded me, said, you know, there's a silver lining here. With our junior priority, we've also planned exceedingly well for those times when we had scarcer water supplies. We've built in conservation into our water budgets. We have done this tremendous job with building storage facilities, both above ground and below ground. There's a general ethic of this is a valuable, scarce resource. We have to manage it wisely. So in a sense, you know, because we've known we've got the short straw in that pool of water, we've managed, I think, more appropriately than some of our neighbors have done. So there is good news in this story. Because we've woken up to the notion that these extended droughts are out there, we are managing the Colorado River system differently. In the last decade, there have been some substantial changes, and I can talk about that if you'd like, but we have dramatically changed how we manage that system. We used to say, what's mine is mine, and good luck you on the other side of that political boundary. In the lower basin today, we now look at managing water across political lines, which is really an extraordinary step in water management. As they said, we hear climate change, you know, big buzzword, and the truth of the matter is we really don't know what the impact is going to be here in Arizona. A, we don't know for certain that we're going to see increases in temperatures, but to the extent that we do, we know that there will be higher evaporation rates, which will increase our demand just based on that evaporation rate. So we do have to be conscious of this additional demand out there from Mother Nature, and we've got to manage ourselves accordingly. Here's just a nice map of the Colorado River Basin states. Upper Basin states are the four states, Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, and New Mexico. Lower Basin states, Arizona, California, and Nevada. I think what's important about this map is two things. One, look at this, where the Colorado River Basin is, especially in the Lower Basin. It literally is Arizona. One of the ironies is when you look at the allocations and you see them here in red, California is entitled to 4.4 million acre feet of the 7.5 million acre feet that's delivered annually into the Lower Basin, while we're entitled to 2.8 million acre feet. Now, there's very little of the Colorado River Basin that's actually in California, but they put the water supply to use in a significant way. Obviously, the agriculture in Imperial Valley sustains much of the United States and worldwide. It's an important industry there, and that's where the lion's share of the water use goes in California. Nevada, on the other hand, got a paltry 0.3 million acre feet or 300,000 acre feet a year. They've cried many tears over this sort of poor deal they got, quote unquote. At the time, and there are quotes in the records, Nevada thought they were getting a smoking deal. They were basically given 300,000 acre feet. there was nothing but a dust bowl in southern Nevada. You know, Las Vegas, the Flamingo Hotel, et cetera, was non-existent. So they couldn't imagine a time when they would fully utilize their allocation. In fact, it came very, very quickly, and they have been out scouting for additional water supplies. As many of you know, Nevada is storing significant amounts of water here in Arizona in our aquifers because they don't have an aquifer system to store it. And they are storing Arizona's unused allocation. And that is sometimes gets people sort of sit up and go, wait a minute. But Arizona's demand for its allocation, we're entitled to 2.8 million acre feet, a significant block of water, there's no doubt about it. 1.5 million acre feet comes into central Arizona through the Central Arizona Project. So it's delivered to Maricopa, Pinal, and Pima County. The remaining 1.3 million acre feet stays on the river and goes to Bullhead City, Kingman, Yuma, Lake Havasu City, et cetera. That's higher priority water, so you need to make the distinction. 1.3 million of Arizona's entitlement is a higher priority block of water and not subject to shortage in the way that CAP water is. That's junior priority and comes into central Arizona. Yes?
Excuse me, Mayor. When you said Nevada's storing our water, and can you go back, explain that over again?
Sure. In the early 1990s, there was a lot of controversy about the Central Arizona Project coming online. It was completed in 1993. At that point, the price of the Central Arizona Project was substantially higher. And I'm giving you this background. It's actually all relevant. It was the cost to deliver water to agriculture was much higher than anyone projected. So the farmers, who were expected to take the lion's share of the CAP allocation initially, and as we urbanized, it would be converted into municipal demand. But the farmers balked and said, well, wait a minute. It's much cheaper for us to pump groundwater than it is to take the CAP water. Well, it became apparent that the Central Arizona Project supplies were not going to be utilized as quickly as possible. So that's early 1990s. Federal government's beginning to say the credit card debt is due. You know, we're completing the project. CAP, you're obligated to begin to make repayments to the federal government for the cost of this project. California and Nevada are sitting on the sidelines, both using or projecting to use more than their allocation, whereas Arizona was significantly underutilizing its allocation. They had very powerful members in Congress who said, well, wait a minute. It looks like the CAP might have some financial difficulty. We'll be happy to step up and reallocate, take Arizona's unused apportionment and use it in California and Nevada. We said, oh, no, time out. That's not going to work. Well, how do we make sure that we're going to utilize our supply? We were using about 2.2 million acre feet of the 2.8 million acre feet. So 600,000 every year was just left in the system, if you will. California was slurping it up. They, in fact, have historically used 5.2 to 5.4 million acre feet a year instead of 4.4. Well, how did they do that? They were using Arizona's water supply. So we're smart enough to realize we can count the number of members California has in Congress. We know that Nevada has a huge economic machine in the form of Las Vegas. So we started to think about it, and we said, okay, we know we can pay for the CAP. We know we'll have demand by about 2030 or 2040 for all of our CAP supplies. We do not want Southern California to be building houses depending on our water supply. We don't want Nevada to be successful in Congress or in the U.S. Supreme Court challenging the allocation. So we created what is called the Arizona Water Bank Authority. That was created in 1995. That is specifically funded out of the state's general fund to go out and buy the unused Colorado River apportionment that belongs to Arizona, bring it into central Arizona, and store it underground. Its first priority is to provide backup supplies to every Central Arizona Project city. Every city that has that contract now has a backup supply being stored by the Arizona Water Bank. But in order to begin to do that and to make sure that recharge wasn't challenged by the other states as not being a direct use of Colorado River water, we created a bank that said, okay, Nevada and California, we also recognize that you need some water. We're willing to sell some of our unused apportionment today to you on a temporary basis, 1 year at a time. We got some extra water in the system. You can buy it and store it. And they, in fact, did. Not so much California. But Nevada will spend $330 million over the next few years buying unused Arizona apportionment, storing it underground. They're paying the operation maintenance on the Central Arizona project. They're paying capital. They're basically paying all the taxes, a comparable tax base that a city pays for CAP water, plus building the recharge facilities. So they're basically helping spread the cost of the Central Arizona project. But most importantly, they became an ally in protecting Arizona's water rights. Why? Because now they're dependent on Arizona having a secure supply of water so that they can withdraw water in the future. So their future is directly tied to ours. We went from fighting each other over water supplies to now working very cooperatively. But they also understand they're the last entity that gets water in Arizona. It's only if nobody else wants the water, then they can buy it. And it's only on a year-to-year basis. There's no long-term commitment. So they're paying in advance to store the water underground. Then in the future, they make a call on the system. So if they need additional water, they then notify CAWCD, the Central Arizona Water Conservation District, that they have they need the water. The CAP will recover the water supply. And in return, we will pump groundwater, the recharged CAP water that was stored in advance, and deliver it to whoever needs that water supply locally.
One more question. So when you say store underground, you're actually saying take the CAP water and then recharge it underground? You're
exactly.
Not like, there's not underground storage facilities. No, you're just letting it recharge and back into the aquifer. Great,
absolutely.
Thanks.
Here are some of the issues that are out there on the Colorado River, just very quickly. As I mentioned, the lower basin is fully appropriated. There is now more demand than there is available supply. And that's very important because we're hearing lots of discussion about in northern Arizona communities, tribal communities, well, gosh, we'll build another pipeline and divert water off the Colorado. I point that out to you because people are saying that. There are a whole lot more entities out there that think that they're going to get water out of the Colorado than there is a water supply. So I just caution because people keep saying that like that's really a reasonable alternative. It's only a reasonable alternative if you are able to retire an existing use and then take that water supply. There isn't any new water out there, and it is fully allocated. Southern California cities, in fact, the only way that they have been able to reduce their demand on the Colorado, and in large part because of the Arizona Water Bank, it forced a crisis in California in which the farmers had to agree then to sell blocks of their irrigated water supplies to Southern California through Metropolitan Water District and specifically to the city of San Diego. So you've seen this huge transfer, urban ag to urban transfer in Southern California. That's what's made it possible for them to live off of the 4.4 million acre feet instead of Arizona's unused allocation. Now we're taking it and diverting it entirely into the state of Arizona. They had to very quickly go on a water diet and figure out how they can survive on a much smaller block of water. As I mentioned, Southern Nevada Water Authority, which is really Clark County. So that's all it is. The Colorado River water in Nevada is only used in Clark County. Las Vegas, Henderson, et cetera, those very rapidly growing communities. And then the last issue out there in terms of unresolved issues is the demands for water from the Colorado by Mexico and then the environmental demands. We deliver 1.5 million acre feet, we being the United States now, not Arizona. The United States delivers 1.5 million acre feet to Mexico every year. And contrary to often the sort of the myth out there, the United States has never shorted Mexico. They get 1.5 million and some. But there is a concern now that there used to be lots of excess flows going into the Delta of Mexico that began to sustain a significant bird and fish habitat, one of the predominant North American flyways for migrating birds. Because we've now basically put all of this water supply to use in the United States and in Mexico, those estuaries have substantially diminished, and there is significant concern about the survival of the California Delta. And so that demand is something now we're looking at states to try to figure out in conjunction with Mexico how to ensure that there's sufficient water to maintain those ecosystems there.
Councilor Fender.
Quick question for you. Those desalination plants that are just now coming online, does that benefit Mesa at all or generally? They were talking about, I just read a little bit about that.
Yes, indirectly, definitely. One of the big discussions that's occurring right now among the lower basin states and Mexico is whether we can build a desalination plant either along the California coastline. California Coastal Commission is very negative about that concept, but frankly, I think demand will force them to reconsider their position. But in Mexico now, it's sort of they're actively looking at building desal plants along the Mexican coastline. What that means is they then take water directly out of the ocean locally, and then we divert their water supply up above them in the lower basin state, so it's an exchange.
I was talking about specifically that new plant on the Colorado River that catches, yeah, that was the one.
The Yuma Desalter, largest desalination plant in the country. It has been mothballed ever since it was built, and it's now being tried on a trial basis, funded principally by the Central Arizona Project, as well as Southern Nevada Water Authority and Metropolitan Water District. It's generating a block of water that's important, particularly here in Nevada, in Arizona, to add to our overall water supply. And I think it's a very important source of water in the lower basin.
Mayor, just tagging on to that, what is the history? What's the environmental issue or the political issue of why those things were mothballed, or why they don't want them?
The federal government built it at a cost of about $25 million, which sounds cheap today, it cost about $25 million a year to operate it. And they've said, look, there's water in the system, because we've really had additional water. We've had wet years. We haven't had complete demand. So they really didn't need to use the water. So when they're looking at a budget that's pretty tight, they say, let's just leave that offline. So that's really the critical driver. But what happened is the waste stream that comes from the Welton Mohawk Irrigation District, which is in the Yuma area, was providing some significant water supply for the bird and fish habitat in that area. As the desalter comes back online, it reduces that supply of water. It now changes the use of the water in that area. And that became a concern because the environmental community wanted to make sure that there was still an important stream of water available to sustain that ecosystem. And they were concerned that the Yuma desalter, when it came online, would present a long-term threat.
So that plant in itself isn't an environmental issue. It's just what happened to the water around it.
Exactly. This is the other issue out here, which is particularly important and much more locally focused here in Arizona. We have 23 Native American tribes in Arizona. They all have significant claims to water rights in key watersheds. We have had a number of very significant water rights settlements. I'm sure you're all very familiar with the Gila River Indian Community settlement just a few years back. The Fort McDowells, the Salt River Pima Maricopa tribe, as well as the Akchin, have all settled their claims. So the claims here in the immediate central Arizona have been settled in large part through exchanges for their demands or their rights to Gila River water. Instead, we substituted Colorado River water to meet their water budgets. What's important here is that the tribes typically have senior rights to everybody else in the state, first in time, first in right, that sort of notion of whoever put the water to use is going to have the first right. In our case, of course, Western Development came after many of the tribes. The reservations had been created, and they're dated from the date of the reservation, so their senior claims have to be addressed. And we have done so, as I said, with a lot of the Central Arizona Project supply. We have now basically split the pie. If you look at when the Central Arizona Project supply was originally anticipated to be used here in Central Arizona, there was only a very small percentage of water that was set aside for Native American use. The lion's share was going to cities and farms and industry. This percentage has changed dramatically. Today, that pie is now split roughly 53% for non-Indian use and 47% for Native American use. So the change in the allocation of Central Arizona Project water has been dramatic in order to settle these Indian water rights claims. What that means is in the future, and Mesa has been on the forefront with these issues, we're going to have more and more partnerships with local Indian communities leasing their Colorado River supply through the CAP and putting it to use. The concern that everyone has is, one, they very much are quasi-sovereign entities. They have independent thoughts about how they use their water supply, and they certainly are free to determine whether or not they want to lease water. You cannot purchase that water. You can only lease it. You can only lease it for basically a 100-year period. That's the length of the assured water supply program, so that works, but it works on a one-shot basis. What happens when you renew it? So you have to be very conscious of what percentage of your water budget is dependent upon an Indian water lease, because that's a less secure supply than if you have direct title either to groundwater or surface water rights.
Vice Mayor.
Kathy, this is a good time to review CAGRID of what we have, because there are those who may not be aware of the agreement that we have with our folks to the south for our trade-off or our effluent.
Sure, absolutely. That's right. And in fact, in the Gila River settlement, instead of leasing water, the city of Mesa entered into the effluent exchange. And we do believe that it provides us a more secure supply over the very long term.
A little more detail on our trade-off, because we have some new folks here that might not fully understand what we did.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Vice Mayor. We entered into an exchange with the Gila community whereby ultimately we will deliver approximately 30,000 acre feet of reclaimed water, very high quality reclaimed water, down to the community. It's used to irrigate crops on the community. In exchange, on a 5-to-4 ratio, we'll receive about 23,500 acre feet of potable Central Arizona Project water that we can then use for our municipal demands. And this is an exchange that is written in federal law that will go on for in perpetuity. There's no end to this exchange.
It was a very good transaction, a very important part of the Gila settlement. This is just very quickly, just an overview of the regulatory programs we have in Arizona. And you basically have inside AMA versus outside AMA. Well, we're here in the Phoenix Active Management Area, and I have a map in the next slide, but in the active management areas is really where the teeth of the Groundwater Management Act applies. It applies statewide, but the real regulation of access to groundwater occurs through the Groundwater Management Act in the state's five active management areas. And the guts of the Groundwater Management Act are really in two programs. One, the requirement that every subdivision be backed by a 100-year assured water supply, a very important test of the security of that water supply for a 100-year period. Second, conservation programs, and there are all sorts of ways in which we try to stretch our water supply, turf regulations, water duties on irrigated agriculture, limitations on what kinds of water and how much water put in public areas, et cetera. So important ways to stretch the existing water supply. Outside AMAs, we do not have the same types of restrictions on groundwater supplies. We have what's known as the adequacy program. It parallels the AMA program for assured water supply. But the fundamental difference is, if you're a developer coming before a community like Mesa and asking to be approved to develop your subdivision, if you do not have a certificate of assured water supply or a water supply from a designated water provider, you cannot build that subdivision. You will not have a public report issued by the Department of Real Estate, and that subdivision may not go forward. Outside of an AMA, you go through the test of proving a 100-year water supply, an adequate water supply in this case is what we call it. If you can't prove it, you still can build the subdivision. There's no stop in that system to do that. Yes, Councilwoman.
Well, that needs to be repeated because I didn't quite understand that either. But the question, what size subdivision, when you say subdivision, any size subdivision?
any...
Like I come in with 10 houses or 2,000 houses, I have to do that?
That's correct.
I didn't know. Okay. And so what was that last thing? Can you repeat that, please?
Well, the assured water supply, and what's a little confusing is in the active management areas, we call it an assured water supply. That means you have to show to the Department of Water Resources that you have a 100-year supply of water, and there are five criteria that you need to meet that basically meets the test of an assured water supply. So it's not simply sticking a well in the ground and having access to enough water. It has to be mostly renewable water supply. You have to have the financial capability, water quality, and so on. But let's say you meet that test. In the active management area, it's a requirement in order to build your subdivision. Outside of an active management area, it's not a requirement. It's discretionary. So in some cases, in fact, in Coconino County, it is not uncommon for a developer to come to the Department of Water Resources and simply say, I am not going to even attempt to prove a 100-year supply exists to support my subdivision. I will simply take your determination of inadequate water supply. That's not acceptable in an AMA. You can't build a subdivision if you have an inadequate water supply. Not true in Coconino County or in other parts of the state.
And is there a reason why we're not a whole active management area for the whole state?
Back in 1980, when they identified these five active management areas, and in fact there were only four at the time, it was where the bulk of the population was. Also, it was the location where there was significant groundwater mining. So there was this notion of we're going to have to ratchet down access to groundwater and replace it with a surface water use. Outside of those areas, the demand for water wasn't nearly as great, much more rural population.
Now, maybe we need to you talk about getting 100-year assured water supply. As far as the city of Mesa is concerned, those subdivisions that come in within our municipal water system, they don't go through that separate process because they sort of piggyback or as part of our municipal water. We basically determine whether we have within our water portfolio the ability to provide water for the subdivision that comes in within our municipal water system.
Yeah, Mayor, yes, that's correct.
Now, if you're outside of that, you have to go through a separate process as a developer and get an actual certificate from the state before you can move ahead with your plat.
Right.
If you're in the county, outside of that water company. But if you're within the city, we basically handle that. And by bringing them into our system, we assure that we can provide water to them. Just to make sure that every subdivision developer doesn't go through that process if they're under our water system.
Being a designated water provider has huge advantages, and really in terms of the competition, it makes it much easier to develop within the service area of a designated water provider from the developer's perspective. Here's just a map of the active management areas in the state. I've also provided a little bit more of a frame of reference in terms of where the major communities are, but the five active management areas, as you can see from the map, literally run straight through the center of the state, starting with the Prescott AMA, then the Phoenix AMA, the Pinal AMA, the Tucson AMA, and now the Santa Cruz AMA. That's actually split off. It was originally a part of the Tucson AMA, but it's a separate basin, and they determined about a dozen years ago that they wanted to manage differently.
And Reed, if you could just take real quick and explain why pumping in Flagstaff or outside, and mainly outside this Prescott AMA, why that affects us or might affect us, or we have an issue with unregulated pumping that would be outside of an AMA, let's say, north of Prescott, why that would affect us.
Well, and I should tell the council, I represent both the city of Prescott and Prescott Valley, so I do have lots of interest in the issue. And
Catherine, would you explain to us how that... No, go ahead.
Well, the issue here is in what's called the Big Chino Basin, directly north of the Prescott area, that is an unregulated area with respect to groundwater management. It is outside of the Prescott AMA. It is also a significant basin because of its relationship to the Verde River system. The headwaters of the Upper Verde are located in the Big Chino Basin. So the concern that has been raised is whether or not pumping by Prescott and Prescott Valley in particular, as well as Chino Valley, who are in the Prescott AMA and have rights to import water from that basin into the Prescott AMA, whether or not their pumping could diminish flows in the Verde River system.
And sort of to explain how that works, think of a sponge that is dry, it's saturated with water. If you pour water on top of a saturated sponge, the water just flows off the top. And that really happens in nature also. Mm-hmm. If the sponge is dry and you pour water on it, the sponge sucks up all the water. So the question we have is, or the challenge we have is, if pumping underneath the ground in the Chino Valley basically dries up the sponge, then water that would normally flow down the Verde River as surface water then gets basically sucked down into the ground, and that's how pumping under the ground would diminish or potentially diminish surface water as it comes down the Verde. Obviously, since we rely a great deal on the surface water that runs down the Verde River and gets into the SRP system, that's why that's a big challenge and always an issue. Councilmember Richard.
Didn't you say earlier the legal agreements between surface water and groundwater are two totally different?
They are, yes.
Yeah.
They are.
So is there a conflict between those two agreements? Or is there a movement towards correlating those agreements and tying the ground and surface water rights together?
Arizona has always treated legally these two systems separately, separate system of laws. It does not necessarily reflect the reality of the hydrology of a system. There is a gray area, as in all things in life. You've got surface water here, you've got groundwater here. There is a point in which groundwater provides subflow or base flow to a surface water system. A surface water system will get runoff, it will get natural rainfall, it will get melted snowfall. That provides water. So the groundwater is a base flow, there's no doubt about it, but it also, a surface water is getting water from other sources, if you will. In Arizona, that subflow is the question. That's the gray area. Is it surface water? Is it groundwater? We have disputes right now with respect to where the line is, because as is all things in life, it is not black and white. It is very difficult to determine what the extent of the relationship is between surface water and groundwater, and when at some point the groundwater is separate and really doesn't have a direct and appreciable impact on the surface water flow. Now remember, we're all using groundwater, we're all using surface water, so you've got to be very careful. If you define surface water so broadly that it affects all groundwater, it's going to fundamentally change how we use water in the state of Arizona, because we now manage those two systems separately. So the issue is, where do the two meet and how do we treat that supply? Is it a surface water? Is it a groundwater? Where do we draw the line?
Where does effluent factor into that?
Completely separate supply of water. It is owned by the person who produces it until you put it into a open system where someone else can appropriate it, but it is owned by the entity that produces the supply of water. So it's completely different. Just to keep it interesting,
clears mud, right?
The way I look at it a little bit with respect to what's going on in Prescott and Prescott Valley and the Big Chino is not unlike what's happened with Arizona versus California, in the sense of Arizona was fighting California over the use of the Colorado River water. We fought ever since the 1920s. We ultimately got a decision in 1963 from the United States Supreme Court, in which the court fortunately sided with Arizona and said, you know, just because California, you got your first straw in the system, doesn't mean that you own the system, and in fact, it has to be shared. I think there's a parallel argument here with respect to the water in the Big Chino, in terms of the argument that's being made now is Central Arizona, we are heavily dependent upon Verde River flows, therefore we should own it and maintain it. There's an argument that if we don't share, if we don't work together, we're going to have this huge internal battle. We need to figure out a way to share the system.
Well, and like you said, though, there's two things. Number one, sharing the system. Number two, what is really that sponge effect? There's a lot of debate over what, you know, I used a very simplistic model, but does that really affect it? How does groundwater pumping and transfer truly affect surface water? And you'll get a lot of different opinions as to, like you said, there's a lot of gray area, a lot of different opinions as to what that actual effect is.
You're absolutely right, Mayor, and this is really important. You can play a lot of sort of what-if scenarios with water. It is as much an art as a science, and that's what makes it so difficult. So you have to be very careful about what are the specific facts in a particular situation to know whether or not there's really going to be an impact. And even then, we're projecting impacts over 100 years, over multi-generations.
Yeah, a lot of it's anecdotal. I mean, we know that back in the late 1800s, we had a lot of riparian flowing rivers in Arizona. And you know, weather patterns come and go. The one thing that has really changed is pumping of groundwater. Right. Well, we don't have those free-flowing rivers anymore. They've gone, especially down in southern Arizona. You look at the San Pedro, the Santa Cruz. And so that's why a lot of people think, you know, if you look at the mass of ground, the pumping, that's the only thing they can really point to right off the bat is saying, what caused the Santa Cruz to go dry? What is causing the San Pedro to sort of go dry? And ground, so you transfer that same philosophy up to the Chino Basin, and people are, you know, we're concerned. We're afraid. Not only sharing, but, you know, if we share, does that disproportionately affect us by the effects of pumping? And that's just, we don't know. Okay, Vice Mayor.
Well, then along those same lines, we still have our concern about water being pumped out of aquifers and not being recharged into those aquifers, which is a serious problem in the future.
Absolutely, Vice Mayor, yeah. That's something that Mesa has really taken the forefront on as a policy issue, is that safe yield, and I think Rita's going to get to this, but safe yield is legally defined as a condition where pumping equals recharge. Mesa likes to take that a step further and say, yeah, but it needs to equal in the same part of the aquifer, and that pumping in Glendale is not, or pumping in Apache Junction is not equalized by recharge in Glendale. It doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm. Explain why that's the case, as simply as you can.
Sure. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Mayor. Well, you know, in some ways, the whole valley is, as Rita mentioned, a very large bathtub aquifer, but it's very, very large. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of miles across. And so, and the way that water travels through the ground is very, very slow. So when you pump in one portion of the aquifer, those impacts are immediate. Whereas when you recharge in a very different part of the aquifer, potentially hundreds of miles away, it's going to take generations, if not eons, for that water to actually migrate over and equalize the effects of pumping.
And water does flow downhill. I have noticed that.
It does. Yeah. It's true.
I know that's a scientific definition, but it does flow downhill. Yeah.
Just
Councilmember Higgins?
A general question back to our, like, subdivisions that need, if they are in the AMA, which means like County Island, or, and they want to come in for a subdivision, do they have to go through as rigorous of a test with the county to prove they have a 100-year water supply?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, Councilmember Higgins, anyone in the active management area is subject to those.
So that would be our county islands that are between us and.
Correct. They normally go in for what's called a certificate of an assured water supply.
And actually, it's with the state, not with the county, that they do that. But it's a requirement to get a final plat.
Right. Yeah.
You have to have a certificate from the Department of Water Resources and go through this process. Mm-hmm. And usually, they're within some water company. If they're not serviced by the state of Arizona, they either have their own well or they're serviced by. Some kind of group or company or whatever, and then they have to, there's a whole, all sorts of different requirements.
And is that a big arduous task, or it's like, a couple forms, we fill it out, we go down.
No.
No, it's actually fairly arduous. It's a very difficult process to get through, and I think rightly so. It's a good way to guard our resources.
Yeah, I think, my experience is it will take up to a year mm-hmm. or longer mm-hmm. to go work through that process at times. So you know, it's not an easy process.
And Mayor, that's why the designation of assured water supply is so valuable from the development perspective, because you can simply show your will serve letter from the city of Mesa, and that's sufficient to determine that you have an assured water supply, because somebody else has done the homework for you. Here's a perfect illustration of safe yield. And I want you to pay attention to the next slide, because it's even better. But this does kind of give you that sense of trying to establish equilibrium in the aquifer. Yes, the idea is don't pump any more water out of a basin than you can recharge, either naturally or artificially. The goal under the Groundwater Management Act is to achieve safe yield management of our aquifers in the active management areas by 2025. So we're well on our way to that time. If you think about it, the Act was passed in 1980. Safe yield goal is to be achieved by 2025. At the time, that seemed like a long time, and now we're looking it right in the face.
What's the general feel as to where we are on that process? How close?
Not good, Mayor. In the Phoenix area, we do not, the Department of Water Resources has put on record that they do not believe the Phoenix Active Management Area will achieve safe yield by 2025. We've made huge inroads, but we expect that the Phoenix Active Management Area will still be overdrafting its groundwater supply at that time. The interesting thing about the Groundwater Management Act is there's no sort of penalty. You know, what happens when we get to 2025 and we aren't at safe yield in a particular AMA? Does the world stop? Do we stop building what? It doesn't really say. It's silent on that. So that doesn't mean the regulation goes away. Of course, they all stay in effect. But the question will we do something extraordinary? How will we respond when it really becomes crystal clear that we're going to still be in a deficit position with respect to our groundwater supplies?
Councilman. What percentage of wastewater comes back out as effluent? Like, is there a loss during the process of cleaning?
Sure. Yeah, Councilmember Higgins, it's about half. For example, the city of Mesa's total potable water usage, including losses in the system, is about 100,000 acre feet a year. We generate in total about 45,000 acre feet of effluents. Because water usage outdoors is usually about half of your demand. So it's about half, and of that, the city of Mesa, we literally generate all of that effluent, and all of it is put to some type of beneficial use.
So all the actual wastewater that's in your sewer system actually can be turned over and cleaned and recharged in the system. It's just the outdoor usage, that evaporation, that we can't count.
Yeah, Catherine, yes. You say about 50,000. 30,000 goes down to the Gila. Does the other 20 go to the 91st? Where does that head?
Actually, not today, because our exchange with the Gila River Indian community is such that it grows over time.
Oh, okay.
So right now, our deliveries to the Gila community are relatively small. They're about 7,000 acre feet a year. The majority of our water is still going to 91st Avenue. It's still being sold to the Palo Verde Nuclear Power Plant and to Buckeye Irrigation Company.
Okay.
We're also recharging up at the Granite Reef Underground Storage Project on the Pima community. And then we, of course, do deliver some amount of water to the Superstition Springs.
And maybe people didn't realize that. If you go west of 91st Avenue Plant, where the Gila River is actually a
river again.
A river.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's a riparian. Pretty amazing. But all that is treated water.
Mm-hmm.
Every bit of that is treated. Mm-hmm. It's a fairly significant flow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's divided between using for cooling at Palo Verde and used to irrigate non-food crops in Buckeye.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay, right. Pay attention to this slide. This is a good one. Did you guys see my... All right, well, I'm going to give it one more time. Here we go, okay. Trash. A treasure. This is the message for the use of effluent. It really has been viewed as a wastewater supply, and in fact, even the nomenclature is changing. We're now talking about it either as reclaimed water or recycled water. A few years ago, Metropolitan Water District of Southern California attempted the famous toilet-to-tap program. Was a dismal failure for as many reasons as you can think of. But the notion of literally being able to treat effluent to the point that it is now a drinking water supply is, in fact, technically feasible. The question is whether the public's ready to accept that. And we, of course, now can treat water to a fairly high level, to the point where it can be used for everything but drinking water purposes.
Councilmember Higgins.
Yeah, it was my understanding that we do treat, when we put it back in the groundwater, it's really of drinking quality. It's just the mental thing.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
It's above the minimum standards. Right?
Yes.
It's cleaner than the river water that's coming.
Oh, absolutely.
It's coming in.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely, hugely
great.
Valuable supply. And with that, I am done, and I thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Rita. You know, you've got something?
Yeah, I'll go through a couple of issues as they relate to us more locally, and I'll...
Thank you, Rita. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
See, they said to hit escape. And F5, maybe? Maybe try that one. There you go.
Mayor, real quick while she's setting up. I was just looking at this last slide, this House Bill 2518 about gray water to be counted. We don't have any ordinances that require the use of gray water or make use of gray water here in Mesa, do we? I know the city of Tucson is just finishing up some things about gray water use, and just wondering, is that something that we're looking at all or would consider or need to consider in the future?
Mr. Brady, you want to handle that?
Answering Councilwoman Good's question, I'm sorry, what was your question again?
We're talking about gray water ordinance. Well, part of it is we've chosen to handle our gray water a little differently, whereas a reuse, Catherine right. talked about our exchange, for example.
Yeah, Councilmember Richens, and there's a difference between reclaimed water systems, which is what Mesa has invested in, and gray water systems, which tend to be untreated. It's water that's been used in the household but hasn't gone through some kind of treatment process. And there are some water quality issues associated with that. I don't know if Scott Boucher is here, but it's
well, basically, I would say the difference is some communities have chosen to take their wastewater, taking all the different kinds of wastewater in, gray water, black water, whatever. And gray water, just so everyone understands, would be water from your kitchen sink, your shower.
Right.
Black water would be from other places. And, things that have to be treated.
Right.
And what we've chosen to do as a policy is take all of our wastewater, treat it to a certain degree, and basically trade that wastewater for non-potable surface water for the Indian tribe.
Mm-hmm.
So we could either use that water, the wastewater, to irrigate front yards in Mesa. What we've said is that we'll let the Gila River Indian community use that to irrigate their crops, and we'll trade it for non-potable river water so we can put it into our system and turn it into potable water. So in a sense, we're taking that approach, but we're doing it on a macro basis versus on a micro basis. Is that an accurate explanation?
Mayor, does that mean that it's a better trade-off when we do it that way as opposed to, say, new subdivisions have gray water systems for, as a city, will we end up having...
I guess how I would answer Councilmember Higgins is that if we do it on a macro scale, then the city retains a lot more choice and discretion about how that water is used and where it gets used in the future.
Well, and I think in many ways it's a much more efficient use of it because we can collect all of it, we can process it, where if you have an in-subdivision gray water, you have no control over it.
Right.
And you're at the whims of the individual users.
Right.
Reusing gray water takes a lot of effort on an individual basis, either on an individual subdivision basis or on an individual home basis. And, if that system falls into disrepair or if it's not used, then all of a sudden you lose all the efficiencies and you could possibly create a public health issue because it is untreated water.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what we've chosen as a policy is to collect all of that, achieve the same purpose, which is to use every drop of water we possibly can, but we not only use it in an environmentally sensitive way by using it to irrigate crops and not treat that water, but we've also expanded our water supply by basically treating used water for unused water.
Correct. I'll zip through this. I think we've covered most of the points. I'll just cover some of the ones we haven't gone through. Normally here in the city of Mason, when we talk about water resources, we talk about lands that are within the Salt River Project and lands that are outside the Salt River Project. We call them on-project and off-project lands. That distinction is extremely important here because within the Salt River system itself, our member lands, Mesa does enjoy very senior rights to the Salt and Verde Rivers. And so on-project, we have both the water supplies and the infrastructure necessary to meet demand in the very, very long term. So normally what we do is we focus on our off-project lands where we face a lot more uncertainty, a lot more problems, both in terms of legal availability of supplies and also physical infrastructure. Does Mesa have enough water? Yeah, we do. This is, again, looking at just our supplies and demand off project. This chart gives you a flavor for the various different kinds of legal resources that we have to manage. The answer is, yeah, we do, but there are some pretty significant challenges. The two I like to talk about, one is how much we will rely on reclaimed water to meet our off-project demands in the future. What this chart shows you is that we literally, without reclaimed water, do not have enough water to meet future demands. Eventually, about 30% of our demands off-project will originate from reclaimed water supplies. So, and the other important thing to know about this is that generating reclaimed water and using it beneficially so that it can be become part of our municipal demands is very expensive and difficult. So there's a lot of challenges we face in doing this effectively. Likewise with surface water, we also do not have enough surface water to meet off-project demands in the very long term. That is why today we bank so much water underground, so that it will be there in our aquifers for the very long term in the future when we need it. But here again, without banking that water today, we will not be able to meet our supplies in the future. The other important thing that comes from this is we have to maintain adequate wells. Wells are really expensive. They're about $2-2.5 million right now to drill a well. And as we move to the eastern portion of our service territory, we encounter arsenic, we encounter hot water, we encounter pockets where the water availability is just not there. It's very important that we maintain adequate capacity in our wells in the eastern portions of our city. Just real quickly, our water use by sector, about half of our water use is on project, about half off project. There is significantly more multifamily and commercial use on project than off project. One thing that's important to note is that our single family residential water accounts have been declining on project for several years now, but our commercial accounts are increasing. Mesa's water, just like the rest of the state, comes from groundwater, from the Salton Verde systems, and from the Colorado River system. But I'm proud to say, where you saw on the slide that Rita presented, that statewide pumping is about 40%. Here in Mesa, we use less than 10%. And in fact, it used a couple years ago was about 10% of our demand was met by groundwater pumping. We've been working really closely with the guys in the operating room, Randy Ottens in particular, to really ratchet that number down, and they've made some operational changes that have brought us pretty close to 5% groundwater use, which is excellent. We also, as I mentioned, bank a significant amount of water underground so that we can use it in the future. And Rita asked the question, well, what if an extended drought is normal? The good news is we have a plan. We've thought about it. As she mentioned, the water bank stores water on behalf of us so that that water will be available to us in our aquifers in the future. Again, we got to make sure we have enough wells, because when everything's said and done and climate change, you know, does what it does and we have extended droughts, you have to have the security of those wells. And also, again, I want to emphasize that's why Mesa has really been on the policy forefront of trying to push forward this concept that groundwater should be used as the supply of last resort. Currently, in the Phoenix Active Management Area, it is more often used as the supply of cheapest and earliest convenience. And that's an economic choice. It's one that we feel very strongly about. Yeah.
Vice Mayor.
Sorry.
Okay, going back to that, we're planning. We're doing our banking and storing in the aquifer. But back to the previous concern of southeast of us, where they're still pumping, they're drawing down our aquifer, and yeah, even though legally it's our water, in a real sustained drought reality, what's going to happen?
Well, Vice Mayor, let me say one thing. First of all, Mesa has legal access to the groundwater underneath it, but unfortunately, what we face here in the Phoenix Active Management Area is somewhat of the tragedy of the commons. There's nothing that prohibits the communities to the east of us from pumping as much groundwater as they want, so long as they can be members of the Central Arizona Groundwater Replenishment District. So it's not, what they're doing is not illegal. They're not technically taking our water, but certainly we feel the impacts of that. We supply, the City of Mesa, through wholesale agreements, does supply some surface water to the Arizona Water Company service territory and the Apache Junction water service territory to the east of us. That totals maybe 3,000 acre feet a year. That is the only surface water that is used east of Mesa. Everything else, east of Mesa, southeast of Mesa, is all groundwater. And the long-term impacts of that, fortunately, they're long-term. The sky is falling, but it's falling slowly. We have time to correct it. We have time to deal with it. But the long-term impact of that is not good.
Excuse me, it's Catherine. Yeah. Did you say southeast of Mesa or southeast Mesa?
No, southeast of Mesa. Mesa.
Thank
yes.
you.
Yes. Yes.
I saw your number in here that we use about 6% of our supply is groundwater pumping. Can you give a comparison to other valley cities about how that? I know we're all part of the same aquifer, but you know what? How does that compare?
Okay, I'm going to do my best here.
Ballparks.
Yeah, thank you. Gilbert, I believe, pumps about 50% of their supply comes from groundwater. I know Tempe, it's almost zero because their water rights to the Salt River Project are even better than ours. I think Phoenix is ballparkish, 10% like us. I think some of the other fringe cities like Gilbert rely much more heavily on groundwater. There are communities then, for example, the town of Queen Creek, which recently bought its first water company, is entirely groundwater dependent, 100%.
But with that, they had to prove to the state that they had a 100-year water supply in groundwater.
In groundwater, that's correct.
But, of course, groundwater could be that huge bathtub using some of our groundwater.
Correct, yeah. And the only recharge that occurs anywhere near that area is actually up on the Pima community, which is, I don't know, how many dozens of miles away that is. Mm-hmm. I think we covered this one, so I'm going to pass through this. But again, this is just the concept of safe yield and groundwater replenishment. Rita also went through Indian water rights. I just wanted to point out to you, since we have the White Mountain Apache Tribe settlement coming up relatively soon, we hope, that Mesa has been a party to, I think, every single Indian water rights settlement in the state. There might be one or two we missed. I don't know. Settlements are the way that we get access to additional CEP water. CEP water, the allocation of it, is either controlled by the federal government or by the Indian tribes. So our only way to get it is to enter into these settlements. We have, through settlements, gained access to about 30,000 acre feet of CEP water, hugely important for us. And we're hoping to gain access to another 3,000 acre feet of CEP water through additional settlements. I'm hoping to be able to take the White Mountain settlement to you before the end of the year. Real quickly, I just wanted to give you a kind of a taste of some of our water programs. We have a fabulous water conservation program, started Water Use It Wisely, which is now a statewide and national program. We do have a drought plan. It's listed on the utilities homepage if you're ever bored late at night and want to read something fascinating. We do have ordinances regarding the use of potable water for turf and for lake facilities. And we also have a tiered water rates so that as your consumption increases, the price of your water increases as well, which we hope encourages conservation. Last, the City of Mesa holds the grant for the East Valley Water Forum, and that is the main group through which we try to effectuate better groundwater management in the region. And again, someday effluent is going to be a big piece of our water pie. And it's difficult for me to emphasize enough how important that is to us, how expensive and how difficult it will be to get there. But it's all we've got, so it's what we'll have to rely on.
Catherine, I just wondered where we were, and maybe Mr. Wesley could say, the ordinance that was not going to force you to plant winter rye if you didn't want to. We were working on that one ordinance where your homeowners association can't force you to. I mean, if you want to, free country, but if you didn't want to, then you wouldn't be forced to use this high water usage product.
Correct. We kind of floated the idea of such an ordinance, and I think it went through a fair amount of legal review. We haven't brought it forward as yet, but that's certainly something that we could do.
So you're still working on that?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's not yours? I thought it was in, I'm sorry. It's all out of you.
Right.
Oh, great.
Right, yes. And the idea behind that ordinance, again, the City of Mesa can't enforce such an ordinance, but the idea would be that we would have an ordinance that says that CCRs should not include mandatory high water use landscaping and or overseeding. We would not enforce that, but if a homeowner association went against an individual for not overseeding, for example, that individual would have a defense through the city. That's about the extent of it.
Right, and that's all homeowners usually need is.
Right.
Okay. So we're working on that. It's not a dead issue.
No.
Great. Yeah, and we actually believe that we could provide a defense through ordinance rather than through a common law kind of a thing. Let's not get in. We could spend next hour on that. We'll leave that for another day. But I'd like to talk a lot about that because I'm not sure that. Yeah, we'll talk about
that. There are some issues with that.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Yeah, we'll talk about that later.
Okay. Anything else?
Thank you very much, Catherine.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Okay, the next item on the agenda is hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the neighborhood stabilization program. Mr. Villa. And Ms. Carroll.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. We're here this morning to just to give you an overview of and present to Council our amended annual action plan for the Community Development Block Grant Program to include the activities for the recently created Neighborhood Stabilization Program. We're also going to be beginning today our 15-day public comment period, which goes through November 20th. The difference is that we're going from 30 days, which is normally the requirement for CDBG, to 15 as a result of this program. Additionally, some background. Again, Housing and Urban Development made available to the City of Mesa $9.6 million to deal with abandoned and foreclosed properties under this new program, Neighborhood Stabilization Program. And again, even though it was allocated to the City of Mesa, we still have to go ahead and apply for it. And if it's awarded, we have to obligate these funds within 18 months of the date of the award. And again, to go through the timeline today, we submitted our substantial amendment to the action plan, and we're putting out the 15-day comment period. And then, again, we'll come back to Council on November 20th to submit our final amendment and for the action plan. And with the hope is to submit our application to HUD by November 24th. And then it's estimated by the middle of January that we'll be able to get the funding from HUD at that point. And again, these are the partners that have applied for the funding and that we're going to include through the whole process. We met with the partners last Thursday, kind of explained the process to them and the way we're going to be going through this. And what's going to make this a little different than current CDBG projects is that we've created a neighborhood stabilization management team to oversee the program. And what we're planning on doing is having various staff members within the city and also our community partners be part of this management team in order to completely oversee the program to make sure that we're meeting the project goals. And these are the proposed activities that we're planning on using the fund for: acquisition rehab, acquisition demo, acquisition rehab and homeownership, down payment assistance, and homeownership counseling. And one of the things that I want to point out is that HUD has given us enough flexibility with the program to change the funding around as we see necessary, because the important thing is to allocate and obligate these funds within the 18-month period. And finally,
if I could ask you something.
Just
the allocation here, is that based on priorities, or is that based on perceived reality? Meaning that if we have to spend this within 18 months, are we allocating 5.6 to rental because that's what's available out there right now in your mind, or with what's been submitted to us, or is that a choice?
In order to be able to acquire, purchase within 18 months these pieces of property, it's a lot easier to be able to do that than find the home ownership,
right?
Because that's going to take us a lot longer period to do that. So in order for us to play it safe, we decided to put it in this kind of format. Additionally, in order to meet our 25% area medium income levels, you know, we have to have some rental in there in order to accomplish that. But we felt that more out of having to rather than more as a necessity because of the tight and short time period.
Yeah, because we're running about 60% rental properties now.
Right.
And you know, I'm a little concerned with that if we're looking at sustainability, like we said, and neighborhood stabilization, that I understand the challenges we have with the 18 months, but we also look like we're sort of creating a contradictory type program here where we're looking at stability, and yet we've said that transitory housing does not really bode well for stability. So, Councilmember Richards, you had a comment.
One of the ways I think that they're connecting the dots on this that I thought was a very interesting graphic was in the council report that they gave us in our packets, had a spreadsheet that connected the predicted foreclosure rates, the foreclosure abandonment scores, code violations, and Part 1 crimes. And I want to really thank you guys for the work that you did in correlating these by census tract. This is a lot of work to compile all this information, but I think it helps link the problems with code issues and crime issues and foreclosure issues all in similar areas, and that, you know, these funds, I think this is the right approach to really concentrate on this. It would be neat to stabilize neighborhood through more home ownership if we can, so I think we need to really keep an eye on that, like the mayor is saying about that flexibility. But I think this was the big link towards making this really stabilize an area. And I was stunned at some of the code and crime numbers and how they correlated with the areas that were having foreclosure problems. So I just wanted to thank you publicly for doing this work because it was a significant piece to put together.
Okay. The 18 months, doesn't the money just need to be allocated in 18 months? It doesn't actually, the projects don't need to be completed in 18 months.
Well, contracts have to be signed.
Okay.
And so we pretty much have to have it in place before the end of 18 months as far as properties purchased and contracts signed for the rehabilitation. It has to be signed before the 18 month or it will be recaptured.
But we aren't, of course, purchasing any properties. The nonprofits that we're working with that have applied for the contracts are, okay, people are shaking it. What's going on?
No, matter of fact, most of the nonprofits that came in were not necessarily. Some of them were looking at doing the acquisition. Some of them were really just setting it up for transitional living, and we're going to actually have to go back and work with them. And there may be opportunities for them to do that, but frankly, the way we're setting up in order to get this done quickly and develop the experiences for us to actually maybe go contract out with real estate brokers and others to go acquire this property for in our behalf quickly, where I think we're going to use nonprofits, first of all, just the planning of which areas to target. Looking at the community assets that are already in the area, whether they're schools or parks or whatever there might be, and then trying to figure out strategically where do you develop this kind of large kind of community development zone. So that's how we're trying to utilize them. And then for some of them, even what they applied for, their application actually we think may change over time as we kind of define these areas and see what role they can play.
Mayor. Okay. The question of putting land bank issues, you know, the nonprofits that work with, you know, buying houses, but the land remains with the nonprofit and then the house becomes an affordable housing. I mean, have we looked into, I mean, has someone quoted on doing some land banking of homes? So again, that they become affordable home ownership and hope to stabilize areas.
One of the programs that one of the groups that has applied is considering, it's called community land trusts. And what happens with that in a community land trust is where a nonprofit organization buys a group of homes in an area, and what they do is the nonprofit organization actually owns the land itself, but leases out the improvements to as affordable housing in a particular area for extended period of time, for like 99 years and so forth. And with doing that, what it does, it creates it's done specifically for affordable housing. And what they do is they manage and control the value of that property and those homes over a period of time so people of different backgrounds can afford those properties and be able to maintain them over a long period of time. It's used extensively in areas where there's high land values to make sure that the affordability stays within a particular community to make sure that that occurs. The only little drawback to that is that when you create a community land trust in an area, it kind of holds the value of that property down, and it may have an effect on surrounding properties. It may have an effect on it.
Yeah, I guess historically they have some data in Tempe that hasn't shown that.
Right.
And, of course, the person who's purchasing the house doesn't realize the whole, what's the word, when your house goes up?
Appreciation.
Thank you. Appreciation. The whole appreciation. But a set percent ahead of time, and then the rest of the money stays back in the house to make it affordable for the next person and so on and so forth.
Yeah, it is something that we're looking at, and we will definitely be a part of this project, especially since we're looking at doing clustered areas and stuff. This might be an approach that we might look at doing.
Councilmember Fenter. No.
Thank you, Mr. Vila. I appreciate the good work. I realize you are under, everyone's under time constraints. If I were to have my opinion and push it, I would hope that we would reverse acquisition rehab and acquisition home ownership. To me, these things, from what I think the perceived problem is out there, I would hope that those numbers would be switched. I think it should be, to add to stability and overcome some of the problems that we've had.
Councilman Richens?
Yeah, this is a reimbursement program, right, that the nonprofit has to go out and do some work and they submit for reimbursement, and that's a big cash flow issue for a lot of nonprofits. So you have to, I think we've carefully selected the partners, people that have capacity to do that kind of thing. But to Councilmember Fincher's point, is there a way through that we can, once the project funds have been out, the first time they've been allocated, can we hold that to get towards home ownership? More?
No, I think we've said those around. Let's be clear, too. I mean, there are recent studies that showed a lot of the federal programs have come out of HUD that have promoted home ownership and have qualified home ownership for families that meet their threshold of income have not always been resulting in the long-term sustainability that we have, we may anticipate. And I'm not trying to argue against it. I'm just saying it's not necessarily under the way HUD runs the programs and who's actually eligible to participate in these programs. It doesn't necessarily ensure that the qualifying individuals or families truly in the long term may be able to take on the responsibilities of home ownership. I'm not saying that we should certainly push forward. I'm not just saying that. But I think we also have to recognize that rental may have an opportunity, but maybe the form or the management of rental properties, maybe we provide an opportunity for that to be overseen, maybe some private or contracted purpose, so that there's some rental properties. If you have the management, making sure it's being invested can be done well. We don't know the answer to that today. We will have the flexibility to move this around, and we continue that dialogue with the council in the future.
Let me ask you something. Is that driven by the available stock out there? I mean, are we talking about that there's more fourplex or multifamily type of units that are available or they're readily available, or is this the type of buyer and the type of participant that Mr. Brady's talking about, or is it a combination?
It's both, sir. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to make sure that we cover every basis here. And again, the numbers are flexible, and our ultimate goal is home ownership. We would love to have that. But we want to be able to be flexible enough to do some of the accomplishments of the program, which is the stabilization of the program in itself.
Councilmember Higgins?
I just wanted to point out one of the nonprofits in our community actually not only does that housing, that the affordable housing land bank issue, they actually work with the homeowner. They have to stay in the house a minimum of 5 years, but they actually have counseling on, credit counseling, mortgage payment counseling, how to take care of your house counseling. And they actually this nonprofit works as an HOA almost to come around and say, hey, you're not taking care of your house. We picked you, you've qualified, you take care of it. This is what it means, taking care of house. So it's ongoing counseling with this kind of contract. And, so it's not like, they got a house and then we just dump them. Now, we, the city, are out. The nonprofit community is responsible for assisting long-term those folks.
Can I ask a question now? We'll go to Councilmember Summers.
If we do go into a rental, is the city going to be in the business of managing any of these rentals at all?
We are hoping not to.
Hoping not to?
Well, we're planning not to. We're hoping that most of this stuff.
We will.
Ultimately, the idea is to get this back into the private sector hands. The way we can't transfer these properties without, there's not a profit to be made necessarily.
Right.
Can we get, I mean, I'm speaking for myself and probably others. I think there was some, this council didn't make this decision, but I know the previous council certainly made some policy decisions that as much as we possibly can, the city doesn't want to be in the property management home rental business. Escobedo is a good example of that. And I would hope that whatever we do, that it is very, very temporary in nature and that we have a well-defined plan that the city not take on rental property management as one of our functions. Because unless I'm missing something, I think that was the decision that was made. And I don't sense that there's a whole lot of change in that. I'm getting a lot of heads that are nodding no. So,
Mayor, that is our intention.
Okay.
Councilman Summers? That was exactly the question I was going to ask.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Great. Thank
Just
you.
Just a bit clarification, Mayor and Council, is we're going to be in this business for a while with the idea that we transition it out.
Right.
Whether it's a nonprofit or whomever it might be. So,
well,
I agree. I don't think our long-term plan is not, we don't have anything in our operating plan that suggests that we're going to be the long-term property manager owner.
I just want to make sure, I mean, it's $10 million is a pretty big carrot. And, you know, I would, if we can take that money and use it to better our community, I mean, I'm all for that. And I say we do that and leverage that as much as we can. If we get brought into what ends up being a trap, where with the allure of this money brings us into a situation that we create an ongoing obligation for this city, which may or may not work out the way we want to, I think we need to be very careful that we don't fall into that situation. And I mean, I think that the idea and the one reason we embrace this program is the fact that we could bring this in, inject it into a community, stabilize those communities without any long-term obligations, ongoing obligations. And I think we specifically talked about that in the use of these funds, to not use them in areas where it would create financial obligations, or I would add to that, management obligations of the city. And I hope that through the back door, through this rental or whatever management we have, we don't find ourselves in that trap, because I think it really could come back to bite us. So, Councilmember Summers.
Mayor and Mr. Brady, along those lines, is there a possibility that we can get from staff, before the council approves this, a projection of the operational costs of our decisions here? Guesstimates, say, over for the next 5 to 10 years, how much is this program going to cost us for operating it?
Well, we've already, Mayor, Councilman Summers, we've already included in our application that we're anticipating, at least budgeting for the allowed 10% of the total $9.6 million that will be available for administration.
So if we start,
and that will leasing, that's not necessarily for the city, it could be the nonprofits. Administration also.
But if we start leasing houses even for the short term, are we anticipating that those costs to the city would all be covered by that 10%, or are we going to end up having to manage this?
It will be covered by the 10%.
Okay. The second issue, too, is I think 18 months for this project is fairly unrealistic. And not just for the city of Mesa, but for everybody involved. And with the new administration coming in, we should be putting forth an effort from our intergovs to try to see if they can extend this to a more realistic time frame. Because this is one big rush job, and every time we try to rush something, those unintended consequences never seem to be positive. So if we can maybe focus on that with our federal lobbyists as well to extend this time frame, and I think be a better project for everybody involved, all cities.
Okay.
And again, I just want to reiterate the fact that we're not planning on holding on to any property. We're going to get rid of it as quick as possible.
I think it's, and I believe that you that you're on, we're on the same page. This is one of those things that because of the rush, and 18 months is a short time period, and we're going to have to make some decisions that none of us really feel totally comfortable with, simply because we have a lot of money in a short time frame. And I just want to make sure that that as we make those, we keep an eye on the ball, so to speak, and say, where are we going to end up 24, 36, 48 months from now? And I'm not even so much worried about cost, although that certainly is a consideration. Even if we break even on this, the fact that we are reallocating our efforts and management, and we're creating obligations for the city ongoing, especially considering the budgetary, overall budgetary and organizational challenges we're going to have over the next couple of years, I just don't want to be distracted inadvertently. So as long as we can keep that, keep your eye on where we want to go, leverage this to the max, and not create those financial and operational obligations and burdens that would distract us from other things. Okay. I appreciate that. Okay, any other questions? Thank you.
All right, thank you. And again, we'll be back in 2 weeks with the final plan.
Okay, thank you, Ray. Thank you, Carolyn. Item number three, hear presentation, discuss and provide direction on the zoning code update. Mr. Sheffield.
There's mixed successes out there, you know that.
Yeah, I'd like to hear the not good successes.
There.
Well, I guess it depends on who's managing it.
It depends on what's happening in that community as far as land values.
Sure.
Because there's some right. Properties that are not.
Mayor, Council, we're here today to kind of reintroduce you to the zoning code update project. We've had a couple of other larger projects that have delayed this a little bit. We're kind of going, jumping back into the project full steam, trying to see if we can kind of finish it up and get to a point where we can start resolving some of the lingering questions that are going here. The real quick, this is the initial project schedule that was set when the project was started. We started in October of 2006. We are roughly about 9 to 10 months behind the schedule that we initially anticipated, but we're roughly about 75% done. We've completed quite a bit of research going into this. We've completed the first two of four modules leading to a consolidated draft document. The remaining tasks we have include Module 3 and Module 4, which include overlay districts as well as the administration and processing sections. We need to consolidate the four modules that we have now, certainly with some of the information and new ideas that have been presented through the DMB and the Mesa Proving Grounds project regarding form-based options. We want to look at trying to incorporate some of those ideas into the zoning code update. We have to provide time for a public review and comment period, and then we would go through the adoption and implementation steps. These are the goals for the project when we started, and what I'd like to do is to kind of concentrate primarily on the goals of the project. And as you go through in the future slides, you'll notice that at the top of each slide, there's a reinforcement of how that particular slide relates back to these individual project goals. The main reason for doing a zoning code update is to implement your general plan. In zoning terms, the idea is you have this large scheme, this large vision of how you go about trying to develop your community, and that's generally expressed through your general plan. One of the main tools for implementing your general plan is your zoning ordinance. And so the idea is that generally with each general plan that you have, as you update your general plan, you also update your zoning code to reflect that modified vision that you have with the new plan. Some of the goals we also have are to decrease the ease of use, simplify understanding, update our classifications, update our design and development standards, reflect that Mesa is a maturing city. It's no longer just growing hog wild to the east as it had been. Recognize diverse neighborhoods, and we have several of them. We're trying to encourage reinvestment into our existing neighborhoods, being to go back and take a look at the older parts of town. We want to increase our development options, recognize diversity. We want to encourage the development of business and industry. That was a major goal that was set up by the Mesa 2025 general plan. We want to increase predictability because the idea is the more we have predictable standards, then people can understand both on the neighborhood side as well as the developer side what's expected going into a project, as well as modernize our administration and processing requests. The part of the first thing we did, this is going way back into our module one, is trying to increase the ease of use. We're reducing the amount of language that's there. We're trying to be more graphic, use more tables, try to create kind of a one-page impression on things. We try to use footnotes on the same page and same page for cross-references so we get as much information on one page as we can to the people who are interested. And then long-term, we're trying to get to the point where we can computerize the code to make it easier to use online. Again, going back to the ease of use, we're using different acronyms. Right now, we say, for example, we might have R1. We're proposing to call that RS, or residential single residence. The C1 district, we're proposing just to call NC, or neighborhood commercial. The idea that the acronym would more reflect the title of the name itself. We're also proposing three new districts, a residential small lot district, a mixed use district, or MX district, and then a transit mixed use district, or TMX. The table format we think is important because it allows you to do a lot of things on one page. So without having to thumb through the entire code back and forth trying to find things, if you're interested in an employment district, you can basically take a side-by-side comparison of three or four different districts at the same time, look down to find out what the land use classification for your district is, and then find out right of way, is it a permitted use, is it a council use permit, is it a special use permit, are there other types of additional standards that are required over that, and it's right there on one page without having to flip constantly through the code. This also aids long-term in computerization because we can provide hypertext links with each of those so that if there is additional information that's necessary for that, a person just has to click on it and that additional information becomes readily available. The other thing that we're trying to do is to get away from the laundry list. If you take a look at most zoning codes that were developed going back to the 1920s, there was a very long list of things that you can do in a district and a very long list of things that you can't do in the district. The problem is that uses change and people come up with new ideas and nothing's stagnant. And so they're always having to come to my office and ask for some kind of interpretation as to where does my use fit within these different kind of categories. We're trying to get away from the laundry list, go to a broader classification system so that it becomes a little bit more predictable for these folks, and then I don't have to make quite as many interpretations, and that's good for me. So hopefully we'll get around to that. The other thing that we're doing is we're trying to create kind of a balanced emphasis in our approach. We currently have what's referred to as a Euclidean zoning code, based on a Supreme Court decision from the 1920s, Euclid versus Ambler Realty. And the idea is that it really tends to emphasize land uses over other types of things that zoning codes might regulate. To a lesser extent, it also regulates impacts, how we create buffers between transitioning zoning districts, as well as it, to a lesser extent, regulates form. What we're trying to do is kind of increase those emphasis of the form, increase the emphasis of the impact, and kind of de-emphasize the land use aspect of this with the idea of creating greater predictability all the way across the code itself. We have used a technical review committee to help us with our standards. We've been doing this probably for the last 4 or 5 months. We've utilized volunteers basically from the Planning and Zoning Board, the Design Review Board, and the Downtown Development Committee. And they basically looked at each of the zoning districts and the standards that are related to that. And they have some fairly significant changes to even what the consultant has proposed. We'll be bringing those to you shortly. We have basically one topic left for our technical review committee, and that's just the downtown area. This is kind of an example of how we're trying to meet goals, for example, like trying to encourage reinvestment and increase development options. This is just an example in the single residence district, or what we're proposing to call the RS district. If you have an R16 district now, the idea is basically the lot size would remain the same, but we're trying to encourage greater utilization of that property, or what might people call more efficient use of the property. So there'd be, to a certain amount, less open space. that would be available. But currently, you're allowed to build up to 40% of that lot. We're proposing to increase that to 50%, so you'd be allowed to build up to a 3,000-square-foot roof area on a 6,000-square-foot lot. It's a 10% increase.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
How many new plats or subdivisions or plans that come in are actually developed under the base zoning code today? And how many really come and process through in a PAD kind of situation, even if you have an R16 or that kind of a deal?
Mayor and Council, don't have a number off the top of my head, but it has been a high percentage
of PAD. My experience is that most everything or a large majority are coming through the PAD process anyway, which in layman's terms allows more flexibility and allow you to define within that PAD some of the things we're doing. So in a sense, are we codifying almost a PAD process?
Mayor, we are making some modifications there. I think Mr. Sheffield will get to that here in just a moment when he talks about the RSL districts.
Okay, because a lot of these things you're talking about allowing, it seems like we allow those already, but it's on a site-by-site basis, right?
So instead of having the not knowing when you apply, will I get approval,
okay,
by putting these in the district, then you know. You've got the predictability,
gotcha.
Will get approved.
Okay. Okay, thanks.
And from an administration standpoint as well, part of the difficulty with the PAD process is that each project tends to be different. And so if a person calls on the phone and asks, what can I do, you have to go to a file as opposed to finding some sort of common code that governs these types of things. By doing exactly what you're talking about, by incorporating a lot of what developers have been asking for anyway back into the standard districts, then we basically have all that information available in one spot. We don't have to review these on an individualized basis.
Now, that tandem parking, did you put that in there just for me, considering that has been one of my pet peeves of Mesa zoning?
Mayor, I had you in mind when I was doing
Thank
that.
Thank you very much.
But I have to admit, it's there for everybody to look at.
Oh, I felt so special there for a second. Councilmember Richens.
This example you're using, is this, like I live in a neighborhood that's good old R, I think it's R19 or R16. How does this apply to just a regular homeowner that wants to add on to their house?
Wonderful segue.
You're welcome.
Let me just kind of go to my graphic here real quick. This is the kind of an axiometric drawing what the planning staff refers to as a standard building envelope for an R16 district. The idea is that it's a standard 60 by 100 foot lot. It has standard setbacks, 20 foot in the front, 20 foot in the rear, 5 and 10 on the sides. And you're required to park your vehicles side by side, and they have to be behind the front, or the two required parking spaces are behind the front setback. What we're proposing to do with some of these changes would be basically to increase the buildable area on the lot, so that the area that's in red that you see on the diagram would become available for folks that had not had that land available before. If they had wanted to build an addition into the front or an addition into the rear or even in a small addition into the side yards, they would have had to gone to the Board of Adjustment and requested a variance. And the likelihood of getting a variance for that is very difficult because the standards for a variance in the state of Arizona are very, very high and very, very difficult to achieve.
Now, to follow up, I mean, it seems like one of our big challenges in keeping mature neighborhoods vibrant is that we were just in a house the other day in the Pioneer Park area, and we forget that the average house 40 years ago was probably, 1,400 square feet. And the average house today is probably 2,800 to 3,000, or the desirable, which pushes people into newer communities and out of the older one. And the limitations that you speak of, which would allow people to add on that back room or even a front porch, really created a disincentive for people to stay in older neighborhoods because they could not live and expand and grow in that older neighborhood. And what you're saying is that with these, we will allow that generic growth, not generic, but organic growth, natural growth, to allow a house to grow along with standards and with families.
Exactly.
And not create those barriers that we have with through the variance process. Okay.
Very nicely
Good.
Worded there. The yeah, other thing that we're doing...
I was just going to say, it really seems like you're adding value to existing property by a code change. I mean, I now have some flexibility and value that I can add to my property because a code, a regulatory change. And I think it's a good role for government, by the way.
Well, you also have an incentive to stay because as you grow from, you know, three kids to four kids or different uses or you want to move down, you can stay in the same location and adapt your house and your property, whereas right now we actually preclude that. And we almost force people to go to a different site because they can't grow and adapt their own property. So that's a great move. I like that.
One other thing that I'd like to point out on this is that although we're not necessarily changing the height standard, it's still 30 feet, what we're doing is we're taking away the limitation on the number of stories that you can have within that 30 feet. And so the idea, going back to the prior slide, you could have a two-story house, but it had to be 30 feet, and it didn't, or 30 feet or less. Here, you still have the same 30 feet, but by taking away the story limitation, for example, you can still build a two-story house, possibly have a third kind of bonus room with dormers that's existing under there, and get additional floor area that way, and still stay within the same building footprint, the same building envelope that we had previously. We think this creates additional flexibility for people who have standard zoning districts. Any questions? Okay. We want to introduce a new zoning district called a residential small lot district, or the RSL. The idea basically is to create predictability for something and to allow increased density, but create predictability by saying this is what our design standards are. And so as they meet more and more of the design standards, then they can go to an RSL 2, RSL 3, RSL 5, and increase the number of units per lot by doing that. And so we basically create incentives that way. The better the design, the higher the density for the developer. This is just a quick example of the idea that you begin to allow third stories. We currently don't allow that under small lot situations where they're limited to two. And we also provide incentives to provide building articulation so you don't have flat walls. You have windows that are facing the street. And you get an idea that there's a community that's being created. There's also open space incentives, as well as those types of things. Again, creating development options. The idea and one of the things that's been a criticism of our commercial and office districts is that our design guidelines tend to be kind of generic, somewhat broad, and don't tell people specifically, well, how do I achieve whatever this is? What we're trying to do is create additional measurable building forms through that. An example is fenestration. Fenestration is just how you move a building in and out to create interest to it so that it's not just necessarily just a flat wall that's going across there. And what we would do through what we're doing here is creating fenestration standards. That if the building is so wide, then the building has to move in and out a certain distance a certain number of times. And that we believe that would help create this minimum standard that's measurable. So that again increases predictability because it tells folks this is what we expect in order for you to meet a fenestration standard.
Let me ask you something, and I'm jumping ahead, but I see the proposed 15 dwelling units to the acre of a residential density.
Mm-hmm.
Is density really what defines this? Would this tend to preclude like loft type of situations or
the? The idea is that there's been a considerable interest in trying to mix residential back into the commercial districts.
Right.
And there's two very significant questions that go along that. One is, if you allow residential in commercial districts, what kind of density would you expect to achieve? And what we're saying is that there's probably a minimum that should be there. It's not generally less than 15 units per acre. It's considered more townhome or patio home type of densities. Once you get to about 15 dwelling units an acre, it tends to be more apartment or condominium style, and we're thinking that's probably the appropriate mix. The second question, and we still have, this is part of the administration question that's going to come with our fourth module, is how do you process those types of requests and still protect your commercial districts so that they keep from becoming overly residential? And that's a question we haven't yet resolved yet, but it's one that we have to ask.
I have some questions over whether density is, and I agree with you, but I have a question over whether density is the best determinant as to what kind or type of housing you have. And I know that once you get to 15 dwelling units, you by definition have a certain type of housing. It's more of a condo. But I'm not so sure that that actually achieves the purpose we want to achieve, which is if we have some kind of mixed use within a commercial or an office area, there can be variety of housing. And while perhaps a townhome, which is only 8 to 10 units the acre, maybe doesn't fit, maybe 15 creates a type of housing that in and of itself doesn't really define what type of housing might be acceptable or even beneficial in that kind of environment.
Maybe it might be something like a residential floor area ratio.
Dwelling units. I think maybe we just need to look at that.
What if you wanted some big 3,000 square foot units?
I'm just a little concerned that if we throw that kind of a deal down, yes, we will achieve our purpose of getting a condo or a higher density, but I'm not so sure that that's exactly what we want to achieve on this. I think it's part of what we want to achieve, but really the type of housing is what we want. For example, if we come into an office and we want to put executive housing that are large space condos, well, that may only work out to 9 or 10 units per acre, and we would say, no, you can't do that, which would be counterproductive because we want to create a penthouse kind of environment, and yet we've just said we can't do that. And I don't know how you bridge that gap, but it seems like that might be a little bit too stiff of a.
We can look at the measurement. Okay. I think Mr. Richens has come upon it. What we would probably consider to be a reasonable alternative.
Yeah.
Take a look at floor area ratios rather.
Or perhaps throw some subjective types things in there in addition to maybe a target with maybe as an alternative. If you achieve this, and this goal, then the 15 wouldn't hold steady, but we would achieve our objective of the type of housing we want in that mixed use. Because I think we want to encourage mixed use. Mm-hmm. And that's a big movement from where we are now, where we actually preclude mixed use. And the one downside of the pure Euclidean is we say what you can't do in an area. And I think where we want to move is what you can do, because that's how we benefit. Mr. Wesley.
Yes, and Mayor, in conjunction with that, remember we are looking at creating some new mixed-use districts.
Okay.
And that's where we would really try to designate and create that mixed-use environment. Here we were looking at this is really supposed to be an office district, a commercial district, and we're going to allow some commercial in it. So we'll look at it in all those, bringing together, certainly in some rehab areas, if you're just talking about, that single loft maybe a commercial building. We still don't want to preclude those things. We'll go back and look at how we
move. Okay, because I think one of the objectives that I would certainly be looking for, and I think we're moving a great deal toward that, and one of the things that we've been advancing as we look at Mesa Proving Grounds and the other type of form base, is that we're getting away from the concept that there are certain uses within a district that are not allowed. There's no real good reason other than that's how it's been done over the last 40, 50 years, but if you look at the 3,000 years before that in human history, it was perfectly normal to have housing and offices in the same neighborhood. And somehow we decided that that wasn't right, which is why we have dead zones. And I think that the way we're living is moving more toward those mixed use,
sure,
not as an exception, but rather as that's a normal way of living. And so I hope that our zoning code allows that in a manner that works. We don't want a hodgepodge, but I think we should encourage the type of normal human living that our zoning codes, to a large degree, have tried to work against and have prohibited.
You may be getting to this, and I may be just setting you up for another transition. Say I own a defunct strip center that's empty, it's a C2 or a C3 near a major mall that's fenced off. And
it's like my neighborhood.
We change just very hypothetical. And we change this code. How does that affect me? I own that parcel at C2 now, and this code change, am I still locked into the old C2? Do I have some added flexibility that comes with my property now?
The Mayor, Councilmember Richens, the part of the question is how we determine how to implement the new code versus the rights that a person may have with the old code. If the determination is made that we need to go through and literally rezone the entire city, which is a daunting task, but if we make the choice to do that and we apply the new, in this particular site you're talking about, zone C2 now, the translation to that under the new code would be an LC or limited commercial district. if we did that, then the idea is that they would gain additional rights to the opportunity to have residential uses. We'd still have to determine how residential would be approved to that, whether it be a use permit or it's administrative, or if there's some form standards that they meet and then staff just says yes. But there might, there's some site plan approvals that they would have to go through to do that. But the question is, how do you implement the code, okay, or the new code once you determine this is what you have? And that's another daunting question that we have to still have to answer.
And one I'm assuming we'll get to.
Yes. Okay. We also want to introduce something called community character designations. This is a new concept. The idea right now is that if you have a commercial C2 district in the city of Mesa, the standards in Los Angeles are the same as the standards in Dobson Ranch. And you have two very wide-ranging portions of the city. The standards in Westwood Village are the same as they are in Augusta Ranch. And you have differing communities, you have differing time frames, and you probably should have differing standards to do that. One of the ways we're trying to address that is by creating these character districts. And the ideas that would be is that the more urban portions of the city would have these, what we're referring to as a P or a pedestrian oriented type of standard. The probably the newer ones will have the A's or the more automotive type of standards, the more suburban type of standard. And then the ones that are kind of transitional would have the M or the mixed standards. And the idea is that we would be able to have standards that would be applicable to individual parts of the city that would be more, again, predictable. As it stands right now, there was a code change that took place in 2002. It made the entire city nonconforming except the very newest portions of it. And in order, if someone wanted to come through and make a change to a nonconforming site, they have to go through a board of adjustment process called what we refer to as a SCIP, a substantial conformance improvement permit. What we would do by applying these character standards is go back and apply standards that are more applicable to the time of when certain projects develop. We knew what those standards were. And so P areas would be earlier portions of the city, A areas would be later portions of the city, M would be kind of the middle portions of the city. And you wouldn't necessarily have to go through a board of adjustment process. If a person wants to do some kind of expansion or change or addition, or they want to make a minor deviation to what they were trying to do, then more than likely the standards are already in place. This designation takes care of that, and we don't have to do that. They can probably just handle it through an administrative process rather than trying to prove some sort of standard or finding a fact. And we think that's a better way to go long term. Examples of some of the differences, for example, this is what we refer to as a C1 district now. We're calling a neighborhood commercial. The character designators would change things. In the NCP district or pedestrian district, you'd have a higher maximum building height against you're trying to create more of an urban feel to that. There's a street orientation to the project. The building is up on top of the property. You have a smaller setback, and then you orient the parking. In a mixed type of situation, you have the standard 30-foot that you have now. You have a building that's oriented both toward the street and the parking lot, and the setbacks vary based on the classification of the street that it's next to. So there are differing standards there, but it creates differing character, so you don't have the same thing happening on every corner of the city. Classic example of a limited commercial site that's auto is the classic big box stuff where you see very large parking fields in front of the project. Classic example of a limited commercial would be the Lascendas Village commercial site up on McDowell and Power Road, where you have a smaller property. There's kind of a mixture of office as well as pedestrian-oriented uses. There's a higher quality of design that goes into the project. And then this is a new district that we're trying to introduce. What Mr. Wesley was referring to is the mixed-use district. Typically, this would have a pedestrian character designation to it. And the idea is exactly what you're seeing here. You have a very large sidewalk. You have ground floor commercial and office. And you would have residential uses that would be built in the same building but built above that. And we would have standards that would relate to that. Wanted to talk a little bit about the work of the Tech Review Committee. You see some of the standards on the left that were standards that were proposed by our consultant. After going through the Tech Review Committee, they're, like I said, proposing some very substantial changes to what some of these standards are. That, for example, what we refer to as the R2 district now has a maximum density of 12 units an acre. They're proposing that be increased back to 15. The R3 from 17 back to 20, and the R4 from 25 back to 30 units an acre. Again, the idea is allowing folks to kind of reinvest in these types of things, kind of urbanizing a little bit some of our multifamily districts. They also like the idea of using some of the character designations from the office and commercial districts and translate those into some of the multifamily districts so that, again, you have these character areas and your residential areas begin to have kind of an urban feel in some portions of the city as well as a suburban feel in other portions of the city, create some variety in terms of your housing choices. Again, just a couple of other standards. Again, how that would relate, these are a couple of apartment projects that are in Tempe, P designators, you've got residential properties, high quality design. You don't necessarily have buildings that are set back from the street, you have wide sidewalks, and you're still able to have a variety of housing options for these folks.
Councilmember Summers?
I'm looking at these pictures still, and I'm still wondering if we're going to increase these densities, how do we get, how do we codify in this code that idea of place, livable, walkable, sustainable community, and we're not just increasing density so we can shoehorn more people into larger apartment complexes? Because there's a definite quality definition there between the two.
Part of the issue that you have, and you saw quite a bit of it with the Mesa Proving Ground situation, where you saw circumstances where they want to mix the uses, they want to create a variety of opportunities that are there. They're using mixed-use districts probably quite a bit more than we've seen before. They have a tendency to have minimum form standards that go along with that, so you get a higher quality of design that goes along with it. You have minimum open space ratios so that you're not just shoving houses in there, but you're also providing opportunity for people to recreate. But you're providing options for that recreational area. The project that you see that's on the left here that's in Tempe, they meet their open space requirement by having open patios on the roof as opposed to necessarily having space in between buildings. It's just a differing lifestyle.
But how is that? I mean, it's a different design. It is a little bit different lifestyle, but I assume part of what happened with this project in Tempe is that what was surrounding it, they could walk to the bistro, they could walk, I mean, it's in an urban area. Is this over by ASU or it's
yeah,
by...
Yeah, it should be west of Ash, I think.
Well, there are going to be areas in the city that don't have anything walkable. And what I'm concerned about is creating just huge apartment complexes that have a higher increase in density but don't increase the quality. They're not walkable to anything at all. So what we end up with is just a higher density, lower quality project. How do we prevent basically the old Chicago style of low-income apartments and try to create livable, walkable, sustainable communities?
Mayor and Councilmember Summers, if I may jump in and help Gordon with this one, I think there are a couple of ways that we'll need to address that as we go forward. One is in careful application of the zoning districts as the requests are made and review of the site plans to see how they're proposing them, how they're fitting into that larger context, so we aren't doing what you said and just approving this isolated thing that really isn't working with its surroundings and capturing the overall vision. And then the second part of that is the planning that we're doing, such as in Southeast Mesa, and setting up that plan that's helping bring the pieces together of what we've done on West Main Street that helps set the context for the total area. So, you know, continuing to develop those plans first so that we can apply the zoning appropriately so that the pieces can work together.
Yeah, but Southeast Mesa, not to keep belaboring the point, but in Southeast Mesa there's a single developer. There's a strategic plan community district. So they've specifically identified how they want to lay that out. There's one developer that's going to lay all this out. But there are areas, Southeast Mesa, West Mesa, all over, that are single area lots that sit in the middle of nowhere, essentially. They're not near job centers. And my concern is more for them. How is the infill that we're going to be creating throughout the city going to live up to that, building a better Mesa, sustainable, walkable community, and not just end up as a higher density, you know, 1,000 apartments?
Well, if you look at context, and you brought up a good point, if you look at context, the zoning has to be applied within the context of the general plan. Mm-hmm. And I would assume, I think we're going to need to tweak or look at our general plan designations, because hopefully our general plan is set up so we don't create that island type effect where you don't have a high density urban type in the middle of an area where there are no services because we've planned adequately to put high density near to transportation corridors or near to commercial corridors. But I think even with that, we do have areas where we have high density, or certainly medium to high density, that are surrounding what are now currently neighborhood commercial, which traditionally has been your grocery store and your strip center, with maybe a gas station or a bank or fast food on the corner. And I think one of the things we're going to need to look at is, as we adapt these zoning districts, recognize that if we're going to push that high density toward one area, toward one level of development which is more urbanized, that in order to achieve what I think Councilmember Summers is referring to, the neighborhood commercial really doesn't fit much anymore, and we need to, as we go in and look at these specific cases, perhaps look at how the commercial on the corner or within walking distance is going to develop, and maybe figure out ways to encourage them to create more of a consistent or comparable type of development. If that answers your question, I think you can't look at these things in a vacuum. I think we have to do a better job of looking at it down the road, across the street,
situation. Now that you said that, I think there's a difference there between just the multi-family residential use and the mixed use, where you have that residential over commercial, or even residential tied to that commercial nearby. And perhaps what we should be looking at as far as densities is rewarding those developments that are actually mixing the uses with higher densities, and those who just are looking to do an apartment complex, we keep it at what today's would be.
Well, I would also like to take that one step further, where we have, you know, for example, you look at Ellsworth and Baseline, Augusta Ranch type area, where you have active commercial areas that are completely blocked off from adjoining residential, much of which is very high density, where someone actually has to get in their car, drive out the gates around on Baseline to go to the grocery store. And I think one of the things we might want to encourage in the zoning, especially as it relates to neighborhood commercial, is create some sort of, within the zoning and site plan review, some sort of connectivity or integration kind of an idea, both with the high density and with the commercial, so that although it's not a true mixed use, it certainly is a consistent or adjoining use that brings them both together. And I don't think we've done a good job. And that's not just Mesa. That's
everybody.
In the end, everybody. We've taken this shopping center as being completely separate from the neighborhood next to it. And while we talk about creating walkable communities, then we go ahead and zone and site plan areas that completely not only don't encourage, they actually preclude walking.
We
require people to get into cars and make that proverbial 2-mile trip to go 200 yards. So I think that this is a great opportunity through the zoning code to actually mention that as an objective and offer that incentive, even with existing zoning, that we can offer things that currently not only we're not achieving, but we're actually precluding.
I concur with that. My only concern on the RM district is that I think we should be encouraging the mixed use. If we're going to have urban, that urban has a certain style to it. We need to encourage urban. I'm not interested necessarily in just encouraging the increase in density. I'm interested in increasing density if it supports the mixed use. So that would be a direction I would want to take on this one. But the mayor's point is, I agree.
And Mayor and Councilmember Summers, again, along that line, as we connect that with our transit programs and our transportation planning, then to get those two to work well together.
And I think that the objectives are the same, because there are multifamily and high density developments in suburban settings. And whether it's in downtown Mesa or in Augusta Ranch, which is more of a suburban setting, the objectives are still the same. you want to be able to, if you're going to put people in, into a high-density area, you want them to stay out of their car and create an environment where they can walk to the shopping, where they can walk to the amenity, where they can do whatever, whether it's in an urban setting, which you would assume would come naturally, but in a suburban setting where you may not create that, that faux or real urban type of corner, but at least we create the same objective, which is if we're going to put a lot of people into the same area, the last thing we want to do is to force them to get into their cars and in order to take care of the more basic needs. And I think that's what we're doing now. And we ought to have the advantage to accomplish the purposes that I think Councilmember Summers and I both agree on.
We agree. Not to belabor the point too much.
We've beat it to death already. Let's.
One of the things that we're doing with the commercial districts is we're kind of blurring the lines a little bit between commercial office and residential. And whereas under our current schemes, there's a bright line that's between that, we're trying to blur that a little bit by saying that you can creep residential into that. We may need to think the same way about residential. And especially on some of these higher density residential things, blur that by allowing some office and commercial on a smaller scale to creep into some of the higher density residential districts to achieve some of the mixed use that Councilmember Summers is talking about. It is, but you're creating a zoning district. You don't necessarily need to be exclusive to one activity. Okay. Okay. Oops. Okay. These are just real quickly some of the things that the town center or the technical review committee is proposing. For employment districts, basically a minimum lot size, adopt some of the commercial modifications to foundation base, remove some of the standards that are more commercially applicable than they are to industrial sites, and really serve as a disincentive for some of the industrial applications that we have. For example, taking away the building separations requirement, that serves more of a commercial or multifamily function. And having a minimum building separation or minimum distance between building in an industrial district really doesn't serve that much of a purpose, as well as reducing some of the setbacks, especially in industrial to industrial. You're really not buffering anything. You know, they're both industrial activities. So there's some thought about just going to zero on some of that type of thing. Real quickly to kind of finish up, here's what's next. The Technical Review Committee is finishing up with the mixed use and the TOD districts. They're scheduled to review the Town Center districts this Thursday. The Fiesta District strategic plan, or the plan that's going through right now, includes some design guidelines. There's some thought about incorporating those, possibly as in the form of an overlay district. So we need to take a look at how that might modify the zoning code. We need to take a look at some of the form-based options, including creating a form-based option district so that people can, if they want to, can request rezoning to a form-based option, as well as taking a look at some of the manufactured homes and RV requirements that go along with that.
I don't want to get into a detail here because we've gone way long as it is. But just want to throw something out there that we can talk about later, and as to why a town center district necessarily is a different approach than all the stuff we've been talking about here. I mean, to me, the objective and the philosophy applies whether we're doing something in Mesa Proving Ground or whether we're doing something in downtown Mesa. And I recognize that the nature of the properties may be a little bit different, but it seems like the objective is the same. And I've always wondered why we take a completely different approach to a town center than we would to that exists to a town center that we're trying to create. It would seem to me like they're the same process and the same objective. So just something to maybe we talk about at a different time, in a different place, that I'd really like to look into that.
Sure. A couple of other things. Module 3 staff has, Module 4 staff has. Again, the consolidation of the document and the discussion and implementation of options. And then we had the slide basically to kind of segue into your topic, Mayor, about future discussion issues. Talking about administration process, we had that prior conversation about what should be a council use permit, what should be a special use permit. We'd like to come back to you and talk to you about those things. Again, the development of the form-based district. Make sure the council buys into the concept of urbanizing some of our districts now to create smaller setbacks, maybe higher density, but higher quality design. And if there's some other issues that you've identified we can bring those back as well.
Councilmember Fender?
Thanks. With regard to other issues, I'm hoping that there'll be some support side yard setbacks in our district. Those tend to generate a lot of board of adjustment and code compliance issues. Looking for some flexibility. I've had a lot of opportunity to visit with Mr. Sheffield on that, so I'm hoping that'll be part of the future discussion somewhere.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sheffield. Mr. Wesley, thank you. Okay, next item, here reports and meetings, conferences. I think we can skip that. Mr. Brady?
Mayor, I'm just going to remind the council that we do not have a study session on the 13th, and our next study session and council meeting will be November 17th. I'm also probably going to recommend that we do not continue with the executive session today. I believe we have two council members that are going to have to leave here in the next 5 minutes, so we probably should reschedule that for prior to or as part of the study session on November 17th, if that's okay.
I think that would be good. We'll just start that a little bit earlier because I don't think that council agenda is very – we don't have a whole lot on that council agenda, do we? We always have things.
We're still working on it, but
– still working on adding to it. Okay. Yeah, let's do that, if that's okay with everyone.
Yes. Yeah, I
will. All right. Okay. Therefore, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Moved by Councilmember Summers, second by Councilmember Higgins. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. We are adjourned. Oh, item from citizens present.
No speakers, ma'am.
There wasn't anyone. Thank you. Okay, we're adjourned. Thank you.